must be some kind of way out of here. Say the Joker to the thief.
Yes, that's Jimi Hendrix, All Along the Watchtower. On this day, September the 18th in 1970, they found Jimi Hendrix dead, what they say, from an overdose on this day in 1970. And that begins our day in history here, as we start our day in history. And this day in history has some interesting things for us to think about, given the discussions we're having today on the program. This was a day in 1850 that the Fugitive Slave Law was passed by the United States Congress. On this day in 1850. And that law that was already in the Constitution, we forget this, we talked about this last one of our previous days in history, that it was already in our Constitution that slavery was legal and that you had a right to find your enslaved people and bring them back to the plantation. But what this law did was not just codify that, but make the penalties greater. So there was already a great movement for abolition, and this led to many battles around the 1850s where people were fugitives from seeking freedom. But on this day, this law was passed by the U.S. Congress, resisted by many in the North. And actually, the resistance was so fierce that the stat I read was no more than 350 formerly enslaved people were actually recaptured in the 1850s and sent back into slavery because the resistance was so fierce in the North. Now, this is a day, just a year later, in 1851, the New York Times first hit the streets of this country in 1851. And this day in 1895 was a very, 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 very famous speech, a speech given by Booker T. Washington called the Atlanta Compromise. In the speech, he said that racial equality was a folly and argued that economic freedom and labor would benefit African-American people in the South more than civil rights. He appealed to Southern whites to remember, and these were his words, the loyalty, submission, and faithfulness of the labor force among the African-American people in the South, and assuring them that that folks would lay down their lives for the South if it ever came to that. And the quote was, "Be as separate fingers, yet as the hand in all things essential to mutual progress." And it was an amazing moment. It took place at this Cotton States and International Exposition in Atlanta, Georgia. And it was really opposed by people like William Monroe Trotter and W.E.B. Du Bois, who came out saying that we can't acquiesce, we can't bend down and accept segregation and accept second-class citizenship. It's more than just hard work. So this was the beginning of a great debate and a great battle. This took place on this day in 1895, the Atlanta Compromise. And in regards to our show today, where we open our program about Scottish independence and the vote taking place in Scotland, it was on this day in 1914 that the Irish Home Rule Act became law. It was right after World War One, but it was suspended over and over again between 1914 and 1920 when the Home Rule Act of 1920, which established the British North and the Irish Republic in the South. And it fits now because this has always been a battle and conversation about what is the United Kingdom. What are these two islands? What are these nations, these four nations that make up the United Kingdom? And so it's coming down now to this vote today in Scotland. So there's a great deal more to this day in history, but let me leave it there and encourage you all to go to steinershow.org for the rest of this day in history and, of course, the great music that is associated with this day you'll be hearing during our breaks. We'll be right back as we explore this vote taking place for Scottish independence. That's Blitzkrieg Bop, the Ramones. Dee Dee Ramone of the Ramones was born on this day in 1952. We leap into our conversation here. We have with us in the studio Liam Flynn, owner of Liam Flynn's Ale House in Baltimore. His wife is now in Scotland as part of the independence movement. He joins us here in the studio. We're joined by Leslie Loftus, who is senior contributor at The Federalist, and Don Guttenplan, who is joining us from Edinburgh, where he is the London correspondent for The Nation magazine. Welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Good Hello. To be here.
Good morning.
And you all can join us out there at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. And I've been really interested, Don, in the things you've been writing. But I think before we get to that, let's take a step backwards and kind of remind people this has been hundreds of years of battle between Scotland and England over the issue of independence from the beginning in the 1200s when the British tried to take over Scotland to the Crown King of Scotland, Robert the Bruce, in the 1300s, making the wars for Scottish independence to the Treaty of Union in 1707 that created this formal union between Scotland and England and everything in between. So there's a long history here. Don, so give us a piece of how you've seen the struggle going on and why the struggle is so critical, you think, for not just what's called the British Isles, but for the globe itself.
Sure. Well, I mean, two pieces of that long history to remember. One is that when Queen Elizabeth I died, James VI of Scotland became James I of England. So the two countries had the same king, even though they were separate countries, back in the 1600s. Then they became the same country in the Act of Union in 1707. So in a sense, the Scottish king became the King of England, and then England took over Scotland, and they became Great Britain in the Act of Union. But that didn't settle the matter. There were still fights. There was a rising in 1745 that was put down essentially by the Scottish supporters of the House of Stuart. So James's descendants rose against the Hanoverians, the sort of German kings who had been brought in essentially to keep England Protestant. And that's an important part of this story, is sectarian difference and sectarian struggle. One of the reasons that Scotland was disunited in the 18th century was that you had the Highlands, which were essentially a feudal social order and where there was still quite a lot of Catholicism, and then you had the Lowlands, which were Presbyterians, so they were relatively, I would say, fanatical Protestants. And there wasn't much unity between those two, essentially until Scotland became part of Great Britain. Then you had the British Empire, which Scotland did very well out of. Scotland, the ships for the British Empire were built on the Clyde in Glasgow. A lot of the troops for the British Empire were furnished by Scottish soldiers, Scottish men, and also the great trading houses that kind of furnished the commercial edge of the empire. Many of them were based in Edinburgh. So there was a long period of, I would say, quiet and contentment in the 19th century and the early 20th century, in which, as part of the British Empire, Scotland did very well, and there really was not much sentiment for independence. The Scottish National Party, which is the ruling party now in Scotland, Alex Salmond's party, when it began in the 1920s and 30s, was really a kind of eccentric bunch of nationalists who didn't have much of a following. At the time, they were denounced as tartan Tories. And what changed that in a big way, really, was Margaret Thatcher, partly because Thatcher's policies of divesting the British state of all the things that had nationalized under Labour governments, a lot of those things were in Scotland, British coal, British steel. Those were a lot of Scottish jobs that she was essentially hiving off into the private sector and eventually into unemployment. So part of it was just the economic devastation that Thatcher brought to Scotland. It was very noticeable and very interesting how when she died, there was no mourning in Scotland for Thatcher. And the other thing to bear in mind is that Scotland and England have been voting differently for the last 20 years, so that there's currently one Scottish Tory in the House of Commons. There's one Scottish MP from the Conservative Party. There are 41 from the Labour Party, and of course there's a large number from the Scottish National Party. So as I was told time and time again reporting here, one of the reasons people are pro-independence is because we keep voting against the Tories and we keep getting governed by them anyway.
So, and so Leslie Loftus, let me bring you in and appreciate you being with us as well. And kind of this particular vote is also kind of confusing. People look at it maybe as a vote around the issue of nationalism, but the vote is a lot deeper than that, this battle between what goes on. And it's a very simple question, let me just tell our listeners. It says, should Scotland be an independent country, is what the ballot says. Leslie?
Yes, that is what the ballot says. And I want to go back to something that Don mentioned a bit ago about the Act of Union back in 1707 and the centuries of kind of peace and mutual benefit in the middle. England and Britain entered into that treaty for strategic and security reasons, mostly. And Scotland entered into that treaty for mostly economic reasons. And we still see that those essential... I'm terribly sorry. That's one of my alerts.
That's all right. Go ahead.
Right. We still see that is the benefit that Scotland has taken from, even today, the problems that Scotland might face in separating from Britain are economic, and the problems that Britain might face in the separation are mostly security reasons. And I'm sorry, I lost the track of your question at the beginning.
No, I think you're getting it. I mean, the complexity of this, and I, let me just introduce Liam Flynn in the conversation, too,
yes.
Who's been involved. There's a real complexity to the pro-independence movement that I think that people don't always can grapple with easily.
Yeah, there's a lot of paranoia out there that get closer.
Yeah.
Sorry. There's a lot of paranoia and misinformation out there about the independence movement, whether it's, you know, economics, security, is it a nationalist thing, anti-English, which it's not. It's basically people trying to get their own self-determination when for years they've had to work on what Westminster has to say. So when you've got a country that, yes, has benefited in ways economically from the Union up until the Thatcher years, then there's been a vote for referendum for quite a while. I think there was 35. There was a time in 92. But they've all been interrupted by World War I, World War II. And these days, the problems we're seeing that are not being addressed well enough is that the level of poverty and diabetes and the health issues that are affecting Scotland and most of their decision-making is still being done as Westminster, so they have to have their own self-determination. They would like to go for more of a Scandinavian model.
At Westminster being, of course, the British Parliament and where England's making, yes. In England, where they're making all the decisions. But I, you know, one of the things that, before I come right back to Leslie, is to wrestle with this question about what really is going on here in terms of who this campaign is being led by. And I think people are also on the left really kind of torn on this issue because
it's really interesting. It's really interesting. I mean, I was sort of intrigued by it to begin with because, you know, we on the left are rightly suspicious of nationalism. We've seen it do very ugly things in the 20th century. And in the 21st century, it hasn't really seemed to do much better. If you look at around the world at various nationalist movements and the countries they've produced, or the impulses that generate them, they're not things that chime well with values like, you know, solidarity or mutual support or
This is not a strictly nationalist movement. Of course, the Yes campaign is a collaboration of different folks.
Oh yeah, no. What I was about to say is that the Scottish independence campaign has been very different from those movements. I mean, the easiest way to relate it is that first of all, who gets to vote? You get to vote in this election if you live in Scotland. Period. So, in other words, if you're Scottish, your grandfather was Scottish, your great grandfather was Scottish, and you live in London, you don't get to vote. On the other hand, if you arrived here from Somalia 6 months ago, or a year ago, or if you arrived here from England 10 years ago or 20 years ago, you get to vote. The Scots feel that their future should be decided by the people who will actually have to live with it. And I think that's really interesting, and it's a very different stance from, you know, various other national movements across Europe. So that's one thing.
Go ahead. I want to get Leslie in here, but go ahead, Don. Just finish your thoughts so I can get Leslie back in.
So the other thing that's been going on is you've had two very different kinds of campaigns. You've had the Yes campaign, which has been partly about we want to build a Scandinavian-style social democracy in Scotland, and the Tories in London won't let us, so The only way we can do it is if we cut ourselves loose from them. Mm-hmm. So part of it is divergent social visions. And by the way, you know, Scotland has had devolved powers since 1997, and it's had its own parliament for a while. And two of the things that it's been able to do are, for example, to keep Scottish universities from charging any tuition fees, while those in Britain have to, and also social care, in other words, care for the elderly, in Scotland is free. So you can already see different social values at work in Scotland, and the Yes campaign basically says we'd like to continue in this mm-hmm. direction, and we'll be able to do that more and more full-heartedly if we are our own country and govern our own affairs. The No campaign has been mostly, not entirely, but mostly negative and mostly about how much it will cost, whether they'll be able to keep the pound, whether it will cost jobs, whether things will cost more. And really, I mean, I think part of this is because the Labour and the Tories and the Lib Dems have all agreed to wage a campaign together. And that means that they can't really talk about the things that they disagree about. And, of course, they disagree about which way to go into the future.
So Don, I just jump in because I want to get Leslie in here before we have to go to break and come back to Liam. And Leslie, I mean, I want to get your sense of this because your perspective comes from a more conservative stance politically. I'm curious your perspective on the same thing.
Yes, well, from a conservative stance, first of all, we intuitively understand the idea of self-rule and of Scottish desire for self-rule, and that makes intuitive and complicit sense to us. What obviously we're concerned about is Scotland does want to create a Scandinavian-style social democracy, but a couple of points. First of all, as the No campaign has tried to point out, most of those powers that Scotland needs to do that have already devolved to Scotland. So they have been able to, say, protect their right to free education. And they have had elderly. They've had a very. They get higher payments from Westminster per capita for their social programs. So they have the ability to do that. And also, Westminster is basically bowing down right now, seemingly desperate to keep Scotland in, and has offered more powers to devolve. So Scotland, if they just want to create a Scandinavian-style social democracy, doesn't actually have to leave the United Kingdom to do so.
Liam, one of the things here also, that there are two other issues here, I think, that just on the other side of that, when you talked to me earlier before we went on the program, was the Scottish relationship to Britain and the issues of poverty and dislocation in Scotland. Let me mm-hmm. get to the mic.
Yeah, the well, I think there's worries on both sides whether Scotland's going to be able to maintain an independent country, whether the resource-rich Scotland away from pulling away from the Union, the UK will. Make them start having economic problems. But really, you know, they're going to start having different points of light of stronger influence over the people that are being governed in their lifestyle instead of just being this one dark star in London, Westminster, where all the money goes into.
Dark star. The dark hole of London. But Dom, one of the things that I think is also I'm going to bring in here before we go back to Leslie is that when you have Alex Salmond is the leader of the Scottish National Party. This SNP was an organization that was a minuscule kind of right-wing nationalist party back in the 30s and 40s, and now it's a significant party in Scotland, and that the head of that party could become the next prime minister, Alex Salmond, if they vote for independence, prime mm-hmm. minister of Scotland. But I mean, to talk about who he is. I mean, he's an oil economist who has worked for the oil companies and international banking. So
it's very interesting because Alex Salmond himself is. I mean, as I've written in The Nation this week, he's the most talented British politician of his generation. He's a mm-hmm. very smooth, very smart operator. But one of the things that's very important for readers to understand is that wherever the Scottish National Party started out. When Tony Blair came to power as head of the Labour Party, and essentially moved the British Labour Party to the right, That left a lot of room on the left, and that's where Alex Salmond steered the Scottish National Party. So that the Scottish National Party not only was the party that stood for things like free public education, free health care, stopping privatization of the National Health Service, keeping the National Health Service safe, but when they were part of a coalition government in Edinburgh, they delivered on those promises to such an extent that even though the whole system in Scotland was designed to keep one party from ever having a clear majority, so they have proportional representation. Even though the British don't want proportional representation in London, they have it in Scotland, and the reason was to keep any single party from gaining power. But Salmond and the SNP did such a credible job that they won an outright majority in 2010, and that's what triggered the referendum. It was probably much sooner than Salmond wanted to call a referendum. He probably would have preferred another 5 years of a record and moving and moving slowly towards it and moving public opinion along. But they are now credibly a party to the left of Labour in Scotland. I can't tell you how many people I've spoken to here said, I'm a Labour supporter, I was a Labour supporter my whole life, but after Tony Blair and the Iraq War, that was it for me. I'm voting SNP.
So we have to take a brief break here, and we're going to come right back with our guests and go right to Leslie Loftus to kind of to begin the conversation. What would happen if one side, if the vote went one way or the other? If independence was voted on, if the other was voted on, it was defeated. What would that mean? We'll start with Leslie Loftus when we come back. Speaking of Britain, we're going to break with the Beatles' birthday, recorded on this day in 1968. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Coming back with Ain't That a Shame by Fats Domino on this day in 1956. There was a rock show that was the rock shows were banned by the U.S. Naval Station in Newport, Rhode Island after a fight broke out during a Fats Domino concert. I can't figure out why folks would fight over Fats Domino. He was just, who knows? But anyway, that happened on this day in history, and we play a little Fats Domino for you. We're here with Liam Flynn, owner of Liam Flynn's Ale House in Baltimore. His wife is now in Scotland working with the independence movement. Leslie Loftus is with us. She's senior contributor at The Federalist. Don Guttenplan is with us, who is the London correspondent for The Nation magazine. And you're with us at 410-319-8888. Leslie, let me start with you here and go around the table.
Yeah.
So the vote takes place today. Tomorrow morning we wake up. If we wake up and it says independence, what does that mean? If we wake up and say, and it was independence narrowly lost, what does that mean?
Okay, first of all, if the vote is yes and Scotland votes to leave the Union, it's about 18 months until the formal separation and negotiations about everything. Solomon, John's right, they haven't had enough time not to sway public opinion. Public opinion's actually probably most swayable by the idea of self-rule and Scotland in Scotland's hands. But they didn't have time to nail down any of the details. So we start 18 months of negotiation, what to do with the energy grid, what to do with the banking system, what currency to keep, how to divide the North Sea oil fields, who gets the revenues, taxes. And the biggest one of all that I think has been least discussed is what to do about Scotland's EU membership. Nobody even knows what article of the Treaty of European Union they would use. So does Scotland have to leave the EU and then apply for readmission as a new state? Is it going to try and apply as a modification of the United Kingdom's membership so that it doesn't have any gap, any time in the middle where it's not a member of the EU? But then that means its membership status is going to be negotiated by the EU, or not by the EU, by the UK. Does it need to leave? Does it need to activate Article 50 and leave the European Union and then try to come back in? I think everybody's most nervous about that one because that provision has never been used. And does anybody really want to break the seal on that one? Then you get into all the negotiations that go into it. The UK has many exceptions and provisions to EU membership that has not been provided to recent members, incoming members of the European Union. And if Scotland tries to negotiate and keep those privileges, is everybody else who's come in recently going to balk at that? The implications, if it's a yes vote, are huge. If it's a no vote, Frankly, the Yes campaign has been so so excited, so enthused. Polling today, some of the activism has gotten a little fierce. So if they wake up tomorrow, and especially if it's a tight no, there's going to be some angry Yes voters.
True. And that, Liam Flynn, I think will be.
Definitely correct. One of the biggest unanswered questions is the EU. But if you look at it, the current state with the Cameron Tory government, the UK or England especially doesn't want to be a part of the EU, whereas Scotland will be very attractive to the EU once they are up and running, you know, with the resources and what have you. So now those resources are a big question as well, on whether where they go. I know they've been trying to rewrite the maritime map to give more oil rigs, Scottish oil rigs, to the UK. So
there's already two standards of maps used, depending on whether or not you're talking about the oil resources or you're talking about fisheries. And then you've got all sorts of different map that international law uses to determine maritime boundaries. So it's going to be a complicated negotiation.
So let me get back to Don here. And what would happen for you tomorrow morning? I woke up and it was a yes vote as opposed to a no vote, or the other way around?
Well, to me, nothing happens. in Scotland, I think Leslie's absolutely right that a yes vote is going to be incredibly complicated. It's going to involve lots of negotiations. I think it's interesting that we haven't mentioned oil at all in this discussion, but, you know...
My fault.
Oil is a huge factor here. I mean, one of the big spurs for independence has been the Scots looking at Norway, which also has oil, but which has been socking away its oil revenues into a sovereign wealth fund for the last two decades and is now one of the richest nations in Europe because of what it's been able to do with its sovereign wealth fund, whereas Scotland's oil has been essentially, the money's been shipped south to Westminster. Now, Scotland gets a portion of that back in terms of the higher welfare spending that Leslie talked about. But again, those are decisions that are made by London-based politicians, not by Scottish politicians. So, and a large part of the debate has been about, you know, how much oil there'll be, how long it'll last, who'll get it. But, you know, the pro-independence people have pointed out that if you listen to the No campaign, it's as if having oil wealth is a curse for Scotland. But, you know, there are very few nations that would turn it down.
The
only other thing to note is that if it's no, we're still in unknown territory because of the incredible promises that have been made as in a sort of last-ditch effort to sway the vote. So
exactly.
Scotland has now been offered the chance to have its cake, i.e. full power over taxing and full power over its own spending, and eat it, i.e. continue to be subsidized by the British taxpayer. Now, not surprisingly, there are plenty of British legislators, particularly English Tory legislators, but I'm sure English Labour legislators feel the same way. They just feel that it would cost them more to say so, who don't want to put up with this, who are saying, no, wait a minute, if you're going to give Scotland greater control over its taxing and spending, you should give England the same powers over its taxing and spending. And, of course, that's, on the one hand, a perfectly reasonable argument, and on the other hand, you have to recognize that 85% of the people in the United Kingdom live in England. So if England has those kind of powers, then you are essentially basically talking about a country with a very large dog and a very small tail.
So we have to end this conversation now because we have to go into our next conversation about the Islamic State. But you had one closing thought, Liam, did you? I'm sorry.
Oh, just about the oil and the economy that, you know, here's a country that is producing more oil than Kuwait. And if you look at the standard of living in Scotland, a quarter of the children are below the breadline. Almost 1 million people are below the breadline, which is the poverty level. Health, education, all these issues. You have to look at this and wonder why it's happening. if Scotland is doing so well.
We'll see what happens tomorrow morning, and perhaps come back to this next week and see what happens post-election. I want to thank Liam Flynn for joining us here, owner of Liam Flynn's Ale House in Baltimore, Leslie Loftus, who is senior contributor at The Federalist, and Don Guttenplan from our sister organization, The Nation, their London correspondent. Thank you all so much for being with us for this part of the
You're
Mark Steiner
welcome.
Show.
All right, so lunch.
Thanks for having me on.
Bra.
And we take a very brief break. And when we're going out here with The Wind Cries Mary by the great Jimi Hendrix, a man who changed the nature of how we play the guitar. We lost him on this day in 1970. We'll be right back and look at the Islamic State and what comes next. Stay with us.
And the wind whispers Mary.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. And yes, that's still Jimi Hendrix. Remember him. He passed away, left us on this day in 1970. We are switching gears here as we begin to talk about what is going on with the Islamic State, the United States, its response, and the complexity of all of this. We are joined here by Jenna McLaughlin once again. She is editorial fellow in Mother Jones Washington Bureau. Jenna, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hi, good to be here.
And Dr. Fahim Yunus is with us. Fahim Yunus is National Secretary of Education for the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community and Clinical Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Maryland. Good to have you back in the studio, Fahim.
Thank you very much, Mark.
And encourage you all to join us here at 410-319-8888. Email your thoughts to us at talk@steinershow.org, tweet at Mark Steiner, and comment on the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page, 410-319-8888. Jenna, this is, you know, we've had many debates and conversations on this program and around all of this, and some of the more interesting debates have taken place between people who were part of the left-wing resistance to Saddam, who also opposed the war, and the left in America who opposed the war in Iraq, but are taking very different positions about where we are now. There's a complexity to this, I think, is because of the invasion of Iraq and tearing apart of the nation of Iraq by the American, but by our own government, that has unleashed this complexity in ways that I think nobody really knows how to put their hands around.
Yes, absolutely. I would agree. This issue with Iraq and also Syria is certainly different than it was years ago when we were first there. Partially, absolutely, because a lot of us acknowledge that the U.S. had a big role in the instability that's contributed to the growth and eruption of the Islamic State. And I think that's certainly a part of it. But your use of the word complexity is definitely accurate, because I mentioned this at one point that the polling about people kind of being cautiously optimistic or for our kind of involvement in Iraq and Syria, I think it's partially just because we feel that threat on our home front. Even if the threat isn't immediate, we don't think that people are going to invade us or anything. We see these videos of our own journalists getting beheaded, a British national being beheaded, and we see that right on our Twitter feeds. That kind of thing makes it more real for people, I think. That's definitely a part of it. And just the level of humanitarian horror that's happening right now, I think, is getting a lot of citizens' attention and getting us to kind of think that we can't just sit by and do nothing.
Fahim.
Completely agree. The word complexity is the right word. It's like a surgeon. You know, you open someone's belly and then you walk away. You say, all right, somebody else is going to put it together. That patient is not going to survive. So I always say that the ISIS of 2013, in part, is the collateral damage of 2003. These are the same 15, 16-year-old boys who were running around at that time, and we slaughtered their families. Not, you know, hate to use that term, but that is the reality for someone whose family was bombed, whose house was demolished, and we just walked away saying it's collateral damage. 10 years later, look where they are. And this is the first thing right now, I believe, is an acknowledgement. I have not seen a single person come and clearly acknowledge that that was a mistake. You know, even the polls are now, the American public is acknowledging that. But we need to acknowledge it as a number one gesture of peace, that that was a mistake, that the war on terror actually has created more terror.
I want to come back to what you're saying, Fahim, because if your community, the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, was living in Iraq or Syria rather than Pakistan at this moment, you would be targeted by IS.
No question.
To be wiped off the face of the earth.
No question about it.
Right?
Yep.
So I want to come back to that thought about what should the response be? And you know, you saw in the paper, I saw in the papers this morning, Jenna, that the Australian government had this massive sweep, police arresting people in Australia, claiming that there were Islamic State cells that were about to capture and behead Australians. What do we know about the veracity of all that?
I mean, honestly, these kind of articles coming out about various different governments arresting or kind of patrolling or monitoring citizens that are suspected terrorists have been out for months now. And they're starting to ramp up in intensity as people are more and more aware of all the Westerners that are flocking over to Iraq and Syria through Turkey in the most cases. And it's definitely becoming more prevalent. Certain people that are either suspected or have made any kind of proclamation of wanting to go to Iraq or Syria, the governments are really ramping down on those people. And I don't think that that's going to stop anytime soon. Although I'm not sure how much preventative measure that can create.
And talking about preventative measure, I think that really goes to the heart of the question. I want our listeners to join us here with your thoughts at 410-319-8888 about what a Western response should be, if there should be one, or what kind of response the Muslim and Arab world should make with this at 410-319-8888, and the complexities of who's working with whom at the moment to take on IS. I mean, so right now we see that President Barack Obama saying there will be no boots on the ground, American boots. Well, already there are boots on the ground, and we're seeing the head of the U.S. Armed Forces, the chief of staff of the U.S. Armed Forces, saying that that if I will advise the president to send troops there if I think that's what we have to do to back up the Kurdish and Shiite forces and the Iraqi army that's battling IS. And a lot of people in America are saying, Fahim, this is a slippery slope into what we just left.
Right. And Mark, you raised a very good point. My Ahmadiyya Muslim community were persecuted in many parts, particularly some of the Muslim countries around the globe. But our Khalifa, who we believe is the real Khalifa of Islam, who's been there, you know, the caliphate has been there for over 100 years, has really answered this question in a nuanced fashion. It's again going to the example or a metaphor of a surgery. You don't just stitch the skin and walk away. You have to put together multiple layers in that belly that you've opened up. There are a multi-pronged approach. It's not just war or no war. We need to first make sure that we need to turn up the heat on Saudi Arabia and some of these Muslim countries that, you know, secretly we are in bed with, but they are the ones funding much of this Wahhabism and this terrorism. We need to have a just peace in Palestine and Israel. Those are the epicenters. You know, we need to then empower the folks like Ahmadiyya Muslim community and many other Muslim groups who will theologically engage with these extremists over a long enough period of time. None of that can be done remotely, and none of that can be done by Americans. We need to empower people on the ground and continue to stitch every layer of that human body for a long-lasting peace.
So, I mean, Jen, I mean, this is something I think, you know, we saw Congress really being really kind of in flux and not clear about what it wanted to do, and Republicans wanting to support it, not wanting to support a Democrat, saying that I can't really vote for giving mine to the Syrian Free Army, but and then being pushed into it by Nancy Pelosi. And we don't even know what the Free Syrian Army means anymore. Who is that? And where's the,
right,
where
yeah.
the arms going? I mean, and now we just saw this morning that the IS, which has an incredibly powerful army, more than people realize, obviously, have just moved into Kurdish Syria, taken over 16 villages, pushed people out, and the Kurdish Democratic Party in Syria calling for Kurds from all over to come in and fight IS and push them back. I mean, so I was trying to figure out what my question is, but go ahead, Jenna.
Right, yeah. I was trying to parse the, there were several parts of those statements I wanted to respond to.
Go ahead. Go, please do.
Absolutely. Definitely the question of, you know, who is the Free Syrian Army? Who are the moderates that still remain in Syria? That's a huge question right now that, honestly, experts are not in agreement about. I went to a conference the other day where former Ambassador Robert Ford of Syria, the U.S. ambassador to Syria, who quit this summer, he was saying that though these forces are beaten down a lot, they're a lot smaller, they're more local, they're disorganized, there are still moderate forces in Syria that we can ally with, that we can work with. Though there are other experts that think that this kind of thing, there was a New York Times op-ed, I think, a couple days ago that said that this moderate opposition is not something that we could dream of really relying on to focus against ISIS. While others have said that the Kurds are a force that would be useful for that, and they've proven that thus far in Iraq. So that's definitely an incredibly complicated question about which forces we can rely on to work with in Iraq and Syria, and it's definitely part of this incredibly complicated and complex coalition that we've been discussing a little bit so far that Obama's laid out. And obviously there are some odd couplings here, but the idea of the coalition is very necessary and something that I've heard a lot of people say, that we need to have these partnerships in order to have any kind of success over there. We need to not just go on in there and try to do things ourselves. We need the Arab nations, we need Turkey, a lot of different partners that might take a little time to suss out and kind of plan on our side, essentially. So definitely, again, complexity is the word of the day.
Just to dovetail off of that, because you made a very good point about this being very powerful. I tend to disagree, Mark. I believe that they're not very powerful. Geez, they can't even fill an NFL stadium. These are not even 30,000 people. They're out in the desert, very clear target. They're not, you know, embedded in human beings. What is powerful? What is scary?
I mean,
is the idea.
I don't necessarily mean powerful.
No, I agree, Jenna. I agree with you. Yeah. My point was, I think we're saying the same thing. My point was, it's their ideology that is extremely powerful, that has penetrated from Australia to Pakistan. To give you a data point, we are being told that 40 countries, there's a coalition of 40 countries, there's people, Muslim youth from 81 countries fighting with ISIS against us today. That is what I call a very dangerous coalition. They, without any power, you know, without any White House clout, have created a coalition from 81 countries. Muslim youth are flocking there, and maybe in very small numbers today. But my worry is that there is a swing vote in the middle of that global Muslim community, which is becoming increasingly alienated, increasingly frustrated with their own autocrats, increasingly frustrated with poverty, lack of jobs. And all they have to turn to is this radical ideology. And that is where the power lies for ISIS.
Right.
But, you know, this does beg the question then, and I really, listeners, what do you think at 410-319-8888? It's our lives, our tax dollars, our young people who will be doing this fighting if it goes on, that there's a real danger, it seems, of the United States getting deeply involved in the midst of this crisis and being sucked into a quagmire that we can't get out of, and you also can't parse. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, right now you have with Shia militias going with the Peshmerga of the Kurds fighting IS in Iraq, which came out of Iraq in the first place. But that could blow up in a heartbeat between them because of Kurdish independence beliefs that affects Iran and Turkey. I mean, this is there's a real danger here for Barack Obama, for the United States, for the next president to become immersed in the middle of the struggle.
Right, that's definitely true. I heard a few experts that kind of, I think it was Robert Ford, put together three different pillars kind of that the strategy depends on. One of them is Iraq, one of them is Syria, and one of them is this international coalition. And he just couldn't stress enough that it's going to be an incredibly turbulent ride. And I mean, I don't think that there's anything that anyone can say to get past that. To say that this will be simple, that we can get out at a certain point, that we can, you know, do a certain thing, it's just going to be incredibly complicated. But however, a lot of people have expressed optimism at Obama's plan because it's a plan that could work, essentially. And then we can kind of go from there. We kind of can't expect much better, I feel like.
Let me go get a phone call and come right back to you, Fahim. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Donna, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, hi. I have a question. Because these young men who are gravitating to this radical group are suffering from what we call socioeconomic issues because they're frustrated. What is the United States and other countries going to do to make that change? Because if we're seeing it over there, we're going to see it in Africa with a lot of the radical groups as well. So how do we start providing the necessary economic means that these young people don't feel don't need to have to gravitate to those type of radical groups? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Donna, because it is true. If you look at what's happening, not just in the Northeast Africa and Somalia, but if you look at in the western part of the continent with Boko Haram and the power they've been able to create in certain parts of Northeast Nigeria and neighboring nations, this is not just isolated to IS, and there is a connection here, something that has been unleashed. So go ahead, Fahim.
That's a great question, and this is the irony, Mark. In 1936, we knew the answer. When Dale Carnegie first wrote the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
I have to hear this correlation.
I'm telling you, that is the mother of all self-help books, and this is the irony. This is the country that taught the world how to make friends and build influence. Today, we've forgotten. It's the same old principle of Carnegie. If you look at it, it's a long list, but there is something at the heart of all those principles. You have to be genuine and sincere. That is at the heart of every step of Carnegie. When you smile at people, it better be genuine. When you help them out, it better be sincere. And that is where we are lacking, I think, because we are losing those poll numbers year by year. And nearly 10%, just to give you another data point, 10% of the Palestinians believe that we are a neutral broker in Israel-Palestine. I was just giving a talk in Baltimore the other day, 100 people in the crowd, 95% of the people did not believe that we are trustworthy. So that is the issue. We need to just simply, as we drop bombs over there, we need to drop millions of copies of Dale Carnegie here in the U.S.
I think that the 90% of Palestinians are probably right. The United States is not a fair broker in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and it's not been ever. But I from my analysis and perspective, but I think that Jenna, I think that Americans have a right to be very skeptical of increased U.S. involvement. I just a little pushback on you saying Obama's plan could be good. I'm not sure what the plan is, and we are sending in Air Force and Navy fighter pilots along with a few other nations to back IS up while the Iraq and Kurdish forces are moving in. But that could lead to all kinds of other things. We already have troops on the ground. So what is it about this plan you think makes sense?
Honestly, the plan definitely doesn't have that many specific things that you mentioned right there. It's definitely still forming. I think the thing that makes the most sense is the coalition that we've spoken about is allying with Arab nations, with European nations that have a stake in this as well, and relying on their expertise and their information on the ground to assist us. And I think that Obama's pretty sure on the no boots on the ground thing. As soon as his military officials said that, he came out the next day and said that he absolutely refused to kind of back that up. Right now I honestly think that our best part of the strategy is the coalition.
We have to take a very short break. We're going to come right back for some closing thoughts from our two guests before we turn to Chauncey Whitehead and Miss Ernestine coming into the studio. We're going to break with Kisses Sweeter Than Wine by Jimmy Rogers, born on this day in 1933. We'll be right back.
Well, our children, they number just about four.
Jimi Hendrix, Purple Haze. Maybe this whole world could do a little LSD. It might help them out with this crisis. I don't know. But Jimi Hendrix left us here on this day in 1970. Need a little something like that, given what we're facing. Dr. Fahim Yunus is with us, National Secretary of Education for the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community. Jenna McLaughlin, Editorial Fellow in Mother Jones Washington Bureau. Closing thoughts on the two of you. I think that of where you think especially from your perspective on Capitol Hill, Jenna, what you think will be the next steps in Washington? What do you think they'll do?
Well, honestly, I think the next immediate steps that we'll directly see are, the vote from Senate on whether or not they're going to approve the plan to arm the moderate Syrian rebels, which Congress passed yesterday. So
whoever they may
I think
be.
That What was that?
I said, whoever they may be.
Yes, exactly. Whoever they may be. That's definitely still a question that needs to be answered, which, you know, some of these forces may be people like the Islamic Front, who are definitely not exactly moderate, but that's definitely still to be seen. But I think that's kind of the next thing that we'll have to see is whether or not Senate will pass this and how that kind of plan will pan out.
And Fahim, closing thought from you about this, what you think the West response should be? I'm curious about that.
Of course, there's a short-term response, which will be to some degree a military response, but we are in it for a long game. What is the end game? In the end, we are fighting an ideology. The only way to win this war is to replace that ideology with a better ideology. And I strongly believe that as we are building a military coalition, we need to build a coalition of ideas, and the Ahmadiyya Muslim community would absolutely want to be a part of that coalition, because we are the only community with the caliphate, with the Khalifa for over a century. The only difference is the Khalifa of ISIS is asking his members to wage a jihad of the sword, and the Khalifa of Ahmadiyya Islam is asking his members to wage a jihad of the pen. And the world needs to know about that compare and contrast between those two movements, because they are at the heart of the long game here.
Well, Jenna McLaughlin, once again, thank you so much for the reporting you do down in D.C. and joining us once again, editorial fellow at the Mother Jones Washington Bureau. Always good to have you with us.
Thanks so much. It was good to be here.
And Dr. Fahim Yunus, always good to see you in the studio. Thank you so much
for
being with
us once
again.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, we are going to be joined for our monthly look at physical fitness. We're going out with Jimmy Witherspoon. Ain't Nobody's Business. Died on this day in 1997. We'll be right back.
And my baby fuss and fight, and the next minute
ain't nobody's business. The great Jimmy Witherspoon passed away on this day in 1997. Reminding you on the way to this conversation, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. All right, it's that time of the month. Chauncey Whitehead is in the house, fitness professional, owner of CDW Health and Wellness Lifestyles, community fitness activist who changes human beings' bodies one step at a time.
That's it.
Miss Ernestine Shepherd joins us, personal trainer, professional model, world's oldest competitive bodybuilder at 78 years old. And I'm beginning to get a complex, Miss Ernestine, because you're not in my studio anymore.
be there next month.
All right. And Ron DeSilva joins us once again, Division Administrator for the Baltimore City Cancer Program. Always good to have you with us here as well.
Thank
in
you.
The studio. So, tell us, Chauncey, what are we doing here?
Well, it's September, and good morning, Baltimore.
Good morning.
It's time for our September walk. Ma Ernestine and myself, and of course, Rhonda and the Baltimore City Cancer Program. We're going to have our walk this Saturday, the 8 a.m. at Druid Hill Park. And our theme this month will be our food drive for the fall and the winter. We are asking people to please bring some non-perishable food items because we want to make sure that those that are in need, that they have something to eat throughout the fall and the winter.
So was it same place, same time?
Same place, same bat channel, same bat time. Druid Hill Park around the tennis court areas is where we're going to start.
All right, good. It'll be a beautiful weather for this.
Rhonda and I were talking about it's going to be nice and cool. Yeah. Just there's no excuse not to be out there this month.
No excuse.
No excuse, Mark. No excuse. None.
You know, I was going to ask this question just to see what your thoughts are. Let's go back to Swansea for a moment. We'll go around the room. Yesterday we had the UMA boxing crew on the show.
Yeah, I love them.
These young women who are into boxing, and one of the things that even if you don't get in the ring and box, which I don't do anymore, as you know, but even if you don't get in the ring and box, he was saying on the air, Chauncey, how boxing, the training for boxing, the exercise for boxing, is probably one of the best all-around kind of fitness regimens you can find.
Well, you know what? What I always tell people, if you look at track and field, former track and field athletes and former boxing athletes. They still look good. Have you seen Sugar Ray Leonard lately at almost 60?
Looking good.
You know,
oh, yeah.
You look at Floyd Patterson as he got older. Mm-hmm. Because of the training, there's no shortcuts. There's not a bunch of supplements and a bunch of pills. It's cardio and hard work. You look at most boxers as they age. Oscar De La Hoya still looks good. Pernell mm-hmm. Whitaker. Most of them still keep that fitness that they learn, yeah. that it's hard work, cardio, and mm-hmm. body weight exercises. You can't cut around it.
That's the name of the game.
Oh, that's it. I mean, you know, I dabbled in the fine arts until I got my head ringed a couple of times.
Me too. That's exactly what it was, right?
I still use those same disciplines right. before I get into the gym and lift weights or before I do anything. You know, you got to do your road work. And once right. a boxer right. learns that the road work is the most important part, he or she never forgets it.
That last hit I took in Philly made me realize this was not going to be my game for life.
I remember mine too, Mark. That's why
but
I stopped
you know,
running.
Mark, I've seen in the AARP magazine, Sugar Ray Leonard.
Oh, he looks great.
He looked simply great, and he mentioned the various things that he's doing. It's not, he's not overdoing it, but he's doing enough to stay fit and healthy.
Yes, he surely
yeah,
is. I have that same AARP yes. magazine, and he, you know, he looks great. He's,
and so do
he's,
I.
And so do, I think
so
we
do
all.
I.
And he skips rope, and it's like Myron Esteen said. He's just doing enough. He's not doing enough to try to get in the gym, and that's why we're trying to promote walking. Is that he's just doing enough to stay fit at 58, moving close
right.
to 60, and he just looks great.
And Ms. Ernest, I mean, I think that's it's really important before we turn to Rhonda, that you haven't heard a word yet, she'll jump right in, is that to come back to you for a moment and your story, because I think people who may be tuning in for the first time don't understand where you come from with this and how old you were when you really began thinking about being fit.
Actually, I was 56 years of age
wow.
when I decided I wanted to change my lifestyle. And don't you know, Mark, that has helped me out tremendously. I feel better than I did when I was younger. And then the other thing is, with me doing this, what I want to do is to inspire and motivate others to get started. I truly mean every word of what I say and do. I lead by example.
Right. And you do
which
that.
Which is a great.
Rhonda?
Yeah. You know, I also think that a lot of times, and I hear what you're saying, you started at 56, and I also started in my 50s. And I think it's important because a lot of folks look at, oh, you got to get the kids out of the way, you got to get them out of the house, and then you have some peace. But I'm doing it because at this age, I just want to stay youthful, and I
right.
want to stay healthy, and I want to stay up with my grandkids. Mm-hmm. And I want to be able to, if I fall, be able to get up.
Right.
Without breaking something.
But you're just so precious. You're just as cute as you can be.
So, you know, when we talk about the importance of walking, also diet, I think, is really a critical piece. We all look at diet, among the four of us, the three of you especially, I'm talking about right now, in a very different way. Ms. Ernestine, you have a very strict regimen in your diet, right?
Yes, I do. I eat the same day in and day out.
Yes, she does.
And that's no tail. That's the way I actually eat. And it just makes me feel great. And I don't ask anyone to eat exactly like I do, but to just change some little things that you do. You can have your cake every now and then if mm-hmm. you want it, but not every day. My goodness.
You say not every day.
And also, increasing your water intake, that's what I found. Increasing the water intake, mm-hmm. my fruit intake, of course, some fruits have sugar, so you have to be careful with that. Mm-hmm. But your leafy vegetables, what a wonderful thing. Didn't think I would like it, but I'm telling you, it's working for me, and it's really, and folks need to consider changing your diet.
Right.
And you do consume a lot, Chauncey, but you also run a lot.
Yes, I right? do, Mark. I'm, you know, I do want to say that, you know, I'm not a certified dietitian or nutritionist, and sometimes we need that type of expertise, but I am a runner. And a lot of times people come to me and ask me, well, Chauncey, what do you eat? And mm-hmm. I tell them I eat to run. because there's a lot of times that I consume, as Marner Steen knows, a lot of calories because, you know, when I'm running 7-minute miles for 10, 11, 12 miles, I'm burning, a lot of calories. And I also use that, Mark, as an excuse to eat because runners tend to, she knew how we do. We tend to say, well, I'm eating this pasta and this all this garlic bread because, you know, I'm a runner. But I believe that you should eat to live, and you should eat for the different physical activity that you
do. Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of construction workers, and they're still pounding down their pancakes and their potatoes. But if you're slinging drywall for 10 to 12 hours of the day, you're doing a lot of physical activity. Mm-hmm. If you're sitting in a cubicle for 8 or 9 to 10 hours a day, I don't think the pancakes and the potatoes and all that is a good idea.
No.
Because I've noticed that one of the things about the workouts you give, and we have not worked out, my wife's been working out with you almost every other day, but I have not worked out with you in a little bit because
yes,
of some of this personal stuff going on. I haven't been able to get down to visit you. But the thing, your exercise routine was interesting. This is different than others that I've experienced, is that a lot of the movements you put people through are movements that have to do with your everyday physical activity.
Right. Functional exercise, functional movements. I can remember years ago when I went to a functional exercise class, and I know that as we age in life, whether you're 29 or whether you're 39, 49, 59, a lot of the things that we 69. Need to do are just movements to get us through the day.
Right.
And I believe that the exercise should incorporate functional movements during the day because, as Rhonda knows, working with the cancer program, a lot of times they may not be trying to train for a race. They're just trying to get out of the bed.
Absolutely.
Or trying to make it to the market.
Absolutely.
And please, you know, expand
on that. And it is so important because during cancer, it is so important for your nutritional level to be at the highest and that you're concerned about what's going in your body because you know that you have already, with the chemotherapy or radiation, you have to be so cognizant of what you're eating. And it is, protein is important. You need to get rid of the sugars during this time because you just want to, it's already stressful enough on your body with the chemo and the radiation of these foreign liquids that are in your body. So we want you to be so cognizant of eating healthy. And so those who are going through cancer care, speak with your oncologist. Talk to them about what you're eating so that they can steer you in the right direction. Even if it's a nutritionist that they may steer you to, but it's so important to be healthy, eating healthy, going through cancer.
Oh yeah, and functional exercise. You know, Mark. Because sometimes I've had individuals tell me that they just want to be able to pick their grandkids up. You know, they just want to be able to get out of car without their knee wobbling.
Yes.
And it's like you said, a lot of the different exercise disciplines that I put my clients through, I try to get them to see that each one of these exercises are going to help you get through the day because that's most important.
And also, we as parents and guardians, we really need to look at the children, get them off of the PlayStations.
Right.
You know, the other day my granddaughter said, "Oh, my thumb is bothering me." "Oh, it's bothering you? Oh, I know why. You need to get off of this thing." And so we need to really push our children outside. We don't see in the school systems where they're having gym like they used to have, like we used to have. So these children must. We're having obese children with diabetes, high blood pressure at a young age that should not be.
I mean, that's one of the crimes to me, I think, that when we talk about all this, Ms. Ernestine, is that the whole idea, what's happened to the notion of physical education in our school systems, I mean, that it's just gone.
It is.
Yes.
And the importance of that, of you know, running around the gym, climbing ropes, which was what gym used to be.
That's it. Uh-huh. That's
right.
It. Climbing, playing,
jump
throwing.
And making it kind of, it was play, but it was physical exercise, and we've lost all that.
We most definitely have. But, you know, with the ladies and the guys that I train, we're all just about in the same age bracket. I get some young people, but I know how to train them because I know what I can do, and I'm not going to put them into something that the younger kids would be doing, jumping and carrying on, because we don't want to do that. We want to be mindful as to what we can do. And believe you me, you should see the changes in these people that I have trained. And I'm so proud of each and every one of them. One exercise I love to see that they do, I have them lying directly on their back. and they lift their legs up as high as they can get it. Take the tip of their shoe and take their fingers and hold onto that shoe and can hold those legs up and move them back and forth. Before, they couldn't do it. That's showing flexibility. These are the things that I like for them to be able to do, and they do it.
And they feel good about it.
They do.
And which also is another piece of exercise I think is important, and what I'm going to come to. And folks, I want you to join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Your own thoughts on physical fitness, what you do, and why you're probably going to show up this Saturday to walk with Chauncey and everybody else. But 410-319-8888. Because, you know, I think people who look at working out sometimes as being nothing but lifting weights and doing those kind of exercise. But what Ms. Erskine was talking about in terms of flexibility is kind of critical to...
Extremely. Extremely important, and especially, you know, as we age. Sometimes I look at babies and I wish I could have that flexibility where I could have my foot in my mouth and my
right.
And you realize as we get older, we have to practice and work on flexibility. Mm-hmm. And most of us forget that there's three disciplines in fitness: cardio, strength, and flexibility.
Right.
And flexibility is not stretching. It's actually taking the time to take the muscles through a full range of motion, 60, 90 seconds or longer. It doesn't have to be Pilates or yoga, but just take your time to relax and breathe and stretch. And Myron Esteen is so correct that when you're working with an aging population, one of the disciplines that we should concentrate on more than anything, they're not trying to get strong. They're not trying to lift some weights. But as she said, flexibility. Mm-hmm. The flexibility, the muscles, taking them through a full range of motion. So if you do have a fall, like Rhonda said, you can get back up. Mm-hmm. Your recovery time is going to be a lot better if you're flexible while you're aging.
And also it helps with arthritis.
Oh, definitely.
My goodness. The stiffness that folks get sitting in one particular position. If you've got that flexibility that you're getting with a workout, you'll find yourself getting much better being able to stand up, to move your feet, and your stiffness may not be as long as it has been.
And I'm not flexible. People always look at me when I go to...
You're not flexible?
No. I have to practice it. When I go to yoga classes, and especially Bikram, hot yoga classes, they look at me and they see the long, lean, functional muscle. And I always tell them, I said, don't get this twisted. Don't look at this. I have to work at my flexibility to get in those postures. Mm-hmm. It's so then people say, oh, you really do? I said, yes, I have to work and practice my flexibility. I look like I'm flexible, but I'm really not that flexible. I practice at it. So all of us have a discipline that we can practice at.
Right.
So that's one of those that doesn't come that easy to me. So I really have to take my muscles through a long, full range of motion to be as flexible as I need to be while I'm aging.
And it feels good once you do that.
Oh, yes, it does.
Yeah.
So I talk a bit about, again, I'm going to go back to Saturday, and why you and Ms. Ernestine started these walks.
Go ahead, Mama. Tell them why.
And
tell them
why you think they're so important for our community to be in and what they mean.
Okay. What made me start the walk was the fact that during my exercise classes, at the end, I would always fold my hands and tell my group to make certain that they eat 5 to 6 small meals a day, drink plenty of water, strength train, and make certain that they do some type of cardio. So a couple of my ladies said, you always say about cardio, why don't you start a walking program? So I said, well, okay, I will do that. So another young lady, Faith, and I decided we would start the program. We started it July the 6th, 2013. And at that time, we ended up with about 88 people. And from then on, the next month, we had over 100. And then Chauncey heard about the walk, and he joined us. And he has enhanced the walk tremendously since he has come on board.
Is there a band behind you?
Well, that's good though. That's a segue.
Yeah,
Miss Ernestine's theme, Rocket. So it brings us to walking and running. Miss Ernestine and I, Ma Ernestine and I, we had to walk and run a half marathon. And so one of the ways I motivated her, and we were going up the hills of miles 7 and 8 toward Lake Clifton, is I would call her phone, even though I was standing next to her.
Uh-huh.
Remember that, Mama? I would call her phone, and the Rocky theme would play, and she kept going harder and harder. And so I came aboard the walk to help my fitness mother and the community realize that walking is the easiest, cheapest form of exercise. And most people know that I believe in a community that walks together, talks together.
Yeah.
And then we said, you know what? It'd be great to start partnering with other organizations to enhance the walk, to reach out to the community. We've had politicians come through. We've had all kinds of people.
Yeah.
And we're great to have the Baltimore City Cancer Program as one of our partners.
Yes.
Now, Mama Ernestine, will you wait for everyone like you did last month? That was fantastic. We kept up with you.
Well, you know one thing? That's what I really want to do, because I get the opportunity to talk with the walkers as opposed to me being ahead. I'd rather be back talking to the people. And I've met so many wonderful ladies, young people, gentlemen. I mean, everybody is just so wonderful. And it's my joy just to be around everyone. That's what I want.
Yeah, you know, and it's amazing. We're
going
into our second year of walking the winter time, because we want to show people that you can layer up, you can be you can be healthy during the winter months. You don't have to let the pounds come October, November, December. You can layer up, you can get out and enjoy the fresh, crisp
air.
And it's a lot better than June, July, and August.
Right. And, you know, they sang. They had.
Rocky
should have heard them singing. They had a ball. They just enjoyed. And then also with the school supplies.
Oh, yes, I forgot about that.
We were so proud of everyone.
Yes.
Everyone brought something along. We don't want any money. Money is not what we're looking for. We want things to help out in the community.
That's right. You know, it's thank you, Mama, for mentioning that. Our last walk, Mark, it was our school supply. So we collected. The community was so great. They brought so many different supplies, and we took them over to Patterson Park Charter School. And Ma Ernestine and I were there with the assistant principal and the principal giving out the supplies. And it's just a great feeling, a community that walks together, talks together, and helps each other.
Absolutely.
And it was just a great feeling to know that, not affiliated with any type of government organization, that we just get together as a community to walk and support. Those kids were so happy. And all we did was ask people to walk and bring some supplies.
And they did.
And they did. And just like with the food, we shouldn't have to depend on so many of the food pantries. As a community, we can say, look, we're getting together on a walk. Ma Ernestine and I, come on out, bring some supplies. We're going to feed the community. We're going to walk and talk, and whatever the needs are, we can try to meet them.
So as we run out of here, tell us again.
Saturday, September the 20th, Druid Hill Park Tennis Court area, 8 a.m., 1 to 5 mile walk with Miss Ernestine and I.
Chauncey Whitehead, always good to have you in the studio. Thank
always
you so
good
much,
to be
brother.
Here.
Always good to see you. Miss Ernestine, see you very soon.
I certainly will. Love you, love you, love you.
Love you back.
Love you too.
We
love
Rhonda Silva, always love having you on our studio.
Thank you.
You so
and
much.
The Baltimore City Cancer Program will be on Manic Monday, October the 6th.
Okay.
So tune in, Channel 13, 6:15.
There we go.
Okay.
So we're going to go to break here and come right back. We're going out with Star Spangled Banner.
Jimi
Hendrix.
Oh, man.
Passed me on this day in 1970. Let's do it,
all
Jimmy.
All right.
Thank you all.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.